Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 364. And my guest today is Stephen Cree. I was delighted to get some time with Stephen. We get into it in the podcast, but we've got a mutual friend in Brett Goldstein. And when Stephen was on Brett's Films to Be Buried With podcast, he showed himself to be just a wonderful human. So I knew that we'd hit it off. So although we'd never spoken before, I knew that this would be a breeze. And it truly was. It flew by. We had some time restrictions on us. Otherwise, this would be twice as long. So count your lucky stars that you're not going to have to hear us jabber on for hours and hours on end. We talk about a lot of stuff, but the latest thing, I think we talk about it at the end, that Stephen is in, is A Discovery of Witches Season 2, which started on Sky One and Now TV on January 8th. So you can proper tuck into that. As you'll hear, it's a hell of a thing to get to work on. And it's going to be a hell of a project going forward for Stephen. So you're going to be watching this show in the end. So get started now if you haven't already. But I'm sure a lot of you have. A lot of you will be here because of A Discovery of Witches. A lot of you will be here because of Outlander. And numerous other reasons to be here. So if this is your first time, have a look at the back catalogue. We've got a load of amazing previous guests. Some that come up in conversation in this episode include James McAvoy, Florence Pugh. I'm sure there's another one that we mentioned who's a previous podcast guest, but I have a bit of a browse. I've had everyone on. This is the 364th episode, isn't it? So yeah, if you want to support the podcast, you can head over to patreon.com/scroobiuspip, but you don't have to. It's only a dollar. I don't really do much over there. Although that's a lie really, because if you go on there now, in December, I uploaded 12 video versions of the podcast. So there's loads of content there. But that's very much out of character. I generally just allow you to all sit there in silence, giving me a dollar a month. So don't get your hopes up. But every now and then we do things like Zoom calls and all sorts of stuff. But who knows? You can also head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com for all of my merch, including the Times best-selling Distraction Pieces podcast book. I've all of a sudden started to push that again because I got a lovely message of someone who said they'd been a fan of my music throughout my whole career and loved all the albums, and the albums meant the world. And they bought the Distraction Pieces book just kind of on a whim, thought, oh, he's not doing music anymore, I'll give this a look. And they said that the book now means more to them than any of the records I've done. I've extended that. They only did it in a tweet, and I retweeted it. But yeah, it's made me realise I've got this book that I'm really proud of that came out a couple of years ago, and I should probably push a bit more now. There's not a lot left, and we've done, it's like we're on the final print of it at the moment, I think. But yeah, that's all at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. What am I doing rambling on? Let's get into this podcast. It was a lovely chat, recorded at the end of last year. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 364, with Stephen Cree.
Tricky parts of the last few months doing any of this sort of stuff at home and trying to avoid either your kids or just, you know, because home is no longer quite as quiet as it once was because everyone's at home.
It's interesting though, because the human element is a challenge, but I've genuinely found doing podcasts over Zoom can be really good because when people are wanting to record like in the agent's office or whatever else, offices are always so bare that they're really echoey. Whereas somewhere that's actually lived, yeah, has stuff, has sofas and all that, and it takes away all the echo. So it's been like, it turns out that what people think is a really good room for recording is often just an empty room that isn't ideal for recording. I've done a few like in person where we'll get put in a meeting office and we're just a few foot away from each other and it's echoing all over the place. And you're like, oh man, we could have just gone to one of our houses and hung out in a normal situation.
Well, you've also got a very nice mic on the go there as well.
It's not bad, right? I travel, yeah, with my podcast gear in case of any opportunities coming up. So I've always got that. But I'm doing someone else's podcast on Wednesday And because I've had the same podcast gear for years, and I'm kind of a, I'm not that techie, so I've just, I got some good shit and stuck with it. It's not like a USB mic or anything. And so they were like, oh, is it? So we'll just record the audio feed on Zoom or whatever. I'm like, oh, no, on Zoom, I'm just talking into a laptop mic. It's going to sound like absolute shit, but yeah, it's good fun. But I should introduce you. I'm joined today by Stephen Cree. I feel I need to date all of these because the world is moving so quickly that so much changes. Yeah. So this is, we're recording this just before Christmas. It'll be coming out in January. How are you at this point, I guess?
I'm very well. Obviously, we've just had, it's Monday the 21st of December. We've gone into tier four. Yeah, in London in the last couple of days, which no one knew tier four. I don't know if tier four did exist, actually.
No.
Until 2 days ago. And to be honest, the last, really last 7 or 8 months now has been one kind of perpetual lockdown of sorts. And so it doesn't feel tremendously different. We were planning, obviously, not obviously, but I am from Scotland, as is my wife. We had been kind of semi-planning to go home for a few days at Christmas. All of our family still live up there.
Yeah.
It was always going to be a bit dodgy anyway, because do you want to go home and put the parents under... I didn't want to make them feel under any pressure or feel uncomfortable, given the COVID situation.
But
we've now been banned from travelling up anyway, so it's been taken out of our hands.
I mean... The pandemic feels like one of the biggest leaps in a move to Scottish independence in years, because the way Scotland has handled it kind of and been like, no, we ain't having you stupid Brits in the first half of the pandemic. I've always had family in Scotland, and we sadly had a death in the family, and there was a funeral, and we couldn't attend it.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And that was a shame, but we watched it over Zoom or whatever. It's quite odd, but. Again, it was kind of, as sad as it was, there was a beauty in seeing how seriously they were taking, because at that point it felt like England wasn't taking it particularly seriously, and Scotland were going, no, you're not coming into our country. like we're getting this under control, and we're doing this, handling this as best we can. And it was kind of, it's been an interesting year to watch that, because all of the countries have kind of divided up a bit and gone, right, we're going to do it our way, rather than normally, oh, we'll just agree with or have to go along with what is deemed as the rules. Everywhere's kind of split off a bit and gone, fuck you guys, we're going to do it our way and see how it works out.
It's interesting because I'm actually I got married a few years ago and we started up like a WhatsApp stag chat with like my brother and various other friends. It's basically actually all people from Scotland on it. And there was a real split for a while on that group of independence voters and what the hell was the vote back then? I think it was Remain or Leave. And Remain voters. And even a lot of my mates that voted for independence, they were quite on the fence about it.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, I think, most people that I knew that were voting, they were voting for the opportunity. Down here at the time, there was a feeling that somehow there was some sort of anti-English movement going on up in Scotland. And it was nothing to do with that. It was just, an opportunity for a country in the same way as, Brexit kind of came about.
Yeah.
An opportunity for a country to have its own sovereignty, run its own affairs, and ultimately to get rid of the Tories, who never, ever, ever, ever get voted in Scotland anyway. Now, I've lived in London for years, so I couldn't have voted.
Right.
And I was quite on the fence about it as well. And then I just so happened in 2014 to be doing Outlander, and I was in Scotland for 10 weeks, and I really saw this kind of fervour of positivity around it all. And when the vote came in, I was still a little bit, my heart wanted independence, but my head didn't really. Yeah. Because I think especially now, the way the world is going, and even more so now, I'm all about togetherness, and maybe a fucking pipe dream, but Star Trek, The Next Generation, utopia, essentially, at some point. And all this separation, it's just surely, you know, got to be fucking worse and worse. And with Brexit coming up as well.
I think it's tough, isn't it? Because it's permanent decisions based on temporary situations. Like,
yeah,
I might have been more open to the idea of leaving Europe if it wasn't leaving Europe to be run by the Tories. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Especially this group of Tories.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I was obviously anti-Brexit. Or again, not obviously, but I happened to not have thought it was a good idea. But it did turn into a them versus us rather than looking at the valid reasons on either side of the argument. And similarly with the independence vote, it did feel like a lot of the Scottish people I knew who were pro-independence were largely pro-independence because of the Tories. And as you say, how they've never been voted in up there, but always or regularly had power. But then again, you've got to think that these things are, the way our voting system works is they're meant to be temporary, for better or worse. I think it can be a bad thing. I think neither party can make any great progress because they know that in 4 years or eight years or whatever it'll be, someone else will be in going, let's undo all of that.
Yeah, in a way, actually.
Yeah, it would be a lot better if we could have that utopian, that Star Wars kind of, that unity of everyone together going, let's figure out what works rather than we're going to do it our way. And then when you get in, you'll do it your way and it all falls apart.
I think particularly now with like the next big thing that we're really facing as well around the corner, it's not even around the corner, it's here, isn't it? Mm. It's climate change. Mm-hmm. And that really, 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 really requires the world to be working together as much as the pandemic does as well. And I don't know if looking at the past 8 or 9 months now, how together we are, you know, during the pandemic, during the beginning of the first lockdown, there was a lot of beautiful, I think, and inspiring stuff going on. And as that's gone on, I don't know if that feeling is there as much. And now,
I completely agree. Midway through the pandemic, I thought this is going to be really good for climate change for two reasons. Obviously, the lack of flights and all that kind of thing, just in that temporary time, it's really helped. But I also thought what we saw with the pandemic was people like Trump and people like Boris going, no, it's fine. And then learning that there's something that they can't just talk over.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how much that they say, no, it's not a problem, it's real. And then it's going to have to be dealt with. And I felt that would translate well to climate change because there's so many of them who go, no, 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 it's all exaggerated, it's all this and all that. If they'd been exposed on one issue of saying this virus is over-exaggerated, and then it turns out, like with Trump saying, I think it'll be good if it'll be done by Easter and we can get back to our... And it's like, you can't just make things up. You need to go off science. And that was like a positive thing, that it would put a nail in the coffin of the ignoring science that we're seeing with climate change. But then as you said, as it all went on, people got more and more resolved and resilient in the, no, it is all fake. Yeah. But the deaths are also fake. And they're claiming anyone that dies has died of COVID. And if you sneezed once and then got hit by a car, it's like, that's not what they're doing. But again, I think people's love of conspiracy theories to confirm their own biased opinions is seemingly unwavering.
Well, look at, I mean, if anything, actually, this is even, you know, kind of worse for science because you've now got, and I notice it, you know, I notice it in the chats I'm having with people, you notice it if you're on social media. Everyone's an expert. Everyone has their own opinions. Some people are pro-lockdown. Some people are anti-lockdown. Some people follow Carol Hennigan, and so they believe verbatim what Carol Hennigan says, but some people follow Imperial College. But King's College didn't say what Imperial College says. So then you've got undisputable science being constantly disputed as well, which is slightly the point of science. Science has always been there, and you know, science gets proved and disproven. But now you're getting, because we've got, I think what the big difference in Scotland right now is, and a lot of my friends who were independence voters, I wouldn't say they would still vote independence. I think what they found is that at least Sturgeon is a good orator and seems to be a good leader. But Scotland has made problems as well. Unfortunately, what we've got in Britain is a lot of science being disputed, but then Boris coming out every time and stuttering and stammering and buffering and just talking complete shit. Yeah. And it's hard to trust any of the Tory spokespeople right now, I think. So you've then got science that actually surely has to be based in fact.
Yeah.
But even that is, you know, people are like, well, is that true? And I read an interesting article that said as well, you know, this pandemic also is happening. You know, we've never had anything like this happening, obviously, for 100 years, but it's also now happening at a time of social media.
Yeah.
And social media has changed everything.
Yeah.
So much information getting out there.
Yeah. And so little confirmation of what's right and what's wrong. And I think also social media is responsible for the fact that 4 years ago, however long ago, everyone kind of went, you know what? I'm sick of politicians. I want a real person in charge, like a Trump or a Boris. And now we're all sitting there going, cool, we could really have done with a politician in charge during a pandemic. As said, rather than someone coming out and bumbling, and it would have been good to have a politician come out and go, here's what's going on. You know, like, for better or worse, anything would be better than a real person.
Oh, absolutely.
As such.
Absolutely. You know, you kind of look back and realise how kind of, you know, somebody like David Cameron, now, whether or not, I wasn't necessarily a fan because I'm not a Tory, but I would rather have him, you know, in place right now than Boris.
Completely. Or Blair undeniably did some of the worst things in power. He was terrible, but my God, was he a good politician? Like, he could speak so articulately and calmly and charismatically. People like that, who again, I'm completely anti that guy at this stage, but kind of people like Boris, have you looking back at Theresa May with rose tinted glasses, for fuck's sake?
I know.
That
I know.
Was a hideous time. So,
Jesus, like, bring back the days of John Major. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's loads that I want to talk to you about. I want to talk about Star Fox because that's been amazing. I really want to get into a discovery of witches. I want to get into Outlander. But first of all, let's talk about Brett Goldstein.
I was going to say Brett Goldstein. I knew that's what was coming up.
He's a mutual friend of ours, and I adored your episode of Films to Be Buried With, but I was also heartbroken. And I've not told Brett about this, but it was a heartbreaking listen, because a few years back, Brett hit me up and asked me if I would come clothes shopping with him, or give him some little tips and advice on clothes shopping. And I thought I was his cool, fashionable friend. And then I listened to the podcast, and it turns out you were also his cool, fashionable friend who helped him out with his clothing choices.
Just to point out here, people that won't know this, which is probably the majority of anyone outside of me and you, I've helped you buy probably most of your clothes in the last...
All of my clothes.
All of your clothes in the last 5 or 6 years.
I mean, if the listener is at all interested, I have what I would call zero interest in clothes, to the extent that it depresses me, the very thought of having to choose something to wear, which is why, if you know me, I only wear black or white T-shirts. Black for winter, white for summer.
Yeah. Although today, actually...
Or blue. I've actually moved into blue.
Yeah.
I've never seen
that before.
I think someone else bought it for me, and I was like, oh, I suppose I could wear blue when it's spring.
It looks nice.
Thanks, man. But anyway, thanks for helping me buy all those coats. I'm sorry you died.
Do you know what I have to say? This is the first time I didn't realise that there was someone else that he enlisted as well.
Yeah, I didn't know either. I was listening to this podcast going, excuse me?
For someone who is now, you know, particularly right now in this moment of this year, proven himself to be such a polymath, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's fair to say that he cannot go shopping for an item of clothing by himself. It's a nice kind of, it kind of sums him up quite nicely, I think.
It really does. He certainly knows how to play to his strengths and, you know, and push in the areas he can manage, but he could never be a shop assistant or...
No.
Brett told me to ask about your Michael Jackson online show. I asked him about some stuff that I maybe wouldn't find in my notes or bring up.
My Michael Jackson. I'll tell you what, so I don't actually necessarily have a Michael Jackson online show, but I did a, can you even do a Michael Jackson online show anymore? I'm not entirely sure.
I
did a few years ago. I was sitting in my trailer on Outlander, bored, And I had a headshot of Sam Heughan, who's the lead actor in Outlander. I just thought, I'm going to do something with this headshot. And I thought, I'll just video and make like a mock talk show called Heughan Talks. And I filmed his headshot and I got a headshot of one of the other actors from Outlander up on my computer screen and just did like really, really, really bad impressions of the pair of them. Because Sam Heughan is Scottish as well, but Sam's got a quite soft and almost indistinguishable Scottish accent. You can't really tell where he's from. So I did like a really bad part Irish, part pirate, part Scottish, part English. Like, I mean, horrific accent. And people, like the Outlander fans, sometimes, and I've done a few of them now, and then it graduated to some of his special guests, and the one recurring special guest was Michael Jackson, because I've got a little Michael Jackson doll, who my three-year-old daughter, incidentally, absolutely loves. And for a little while, through no coercion or anything of my wife's or mine, she calls Daddy Jackson for some reason.
Amazing.
And sometimes sleeps with it, which is kind of...
it's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. And anyway, and yeah, funnily enough, there were so many comments from Outlander fans saying, oh my God, your accent is exactly the same as Sam's. Your impersonation is perfect. And if you heard it and you heard what Sam sounds like, you would know that it's not perfect.
On a show I'm on at the moment, I had to do, I'm sure I can say details, I had to do a little bit in Spanish.
Okay.
It was a little bit of a song, and I don't speak any Spanish at all. So I'd been preparing it, but thankfully our director on this episode is Mexican. And so I sent a little recording to kind of get that, because I was concerned. I was like, I think I'm nailing it, but it could just be the most offensive, like, again, a really bad Scottish accent that Americans will hear and go, that is amazing. But Scottish people will hear and go, that is an insult. So yeah, I was worried that, and it turned out it was okay. But yeah,
That's good.
I love those things on, particularly, again, it's big at the moment. There's been a few different fantastic shows in recent years that have had British accents that have been just,
oh my God,
absolutely unbelievably bad. And it isn't until they hit the UK that people are like, did no one know? How did no one know that this was appalling?
Have you seen, and actually I shall also just point out quickly for the listeners that I did, Michael Jackson was a special guest on that show before the Finding Neverland documentary.
He hasn't
been back on Heughan Talk since. I'll just point that out. Have you seen the I don't want to sound like a dick saying this, but have you seen The Haunting of, what's it called? The Haunting of Bly House on Netflix?
Yeah.
Bly Manor?
Yeah.
Fuck me. Am I allowed to swear, by the way? Because I already have several.
Definitely allowed to swear. And again, I'll back you massively in this. I thought it was a great show. I know some people in it, and I thought it was, you know, it's rightfully been one of the hits of 2020, but some of those accents, man.
Yeah. And the weird thing about that show is, despite that, and despite some of the absolutely like painful on the ear, slightly, you know, and obviously there's a Scottish accent. And funny enough, the Scottish accent in it, and he's a good actor, I think, as well. It's not even like it's that bad, because it does sound Scottish. It just isn't Scottish.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of the English accents. Straight from 1920 or something. Yeah. It's quite outrageous, but the show is still so watchable.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Like, what's your opinion on that? Because it's, again, because of social media, it's something that gets discussed a lot, either accents or if someone looks like someone. Like, they recently cast the Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee film, and people were in outrage because they were like, they don't look anything like them. And I'm of the opinion that I want you to cast an actor first and everything else second. I don't want impersonators. It shouldn't be just, oh, they do a really good impression of this person. It's like, they need to be able to act and play the role and deliver it. And obviously there's a balance in between the two, because if the accent is so bad you can't focus on the acting, then it ruins it. But yeah, like, what's your view on that? Because it is a tough one. It does need to be, as you said, the Scottish accent that wasn't Scottish but also wasn't quite offensive is kind of, if that was the only one in the show, you'd probably be able to accept it and move on. But because there was a lot of accents all over the place.
Yeah, there were a lot. Well, I mean, I don't want to be uncharitable because, like, it's tricky doing accents, and it's not, you know, I don't think I'm a master of accents or anything. The weird thing about it is, right, okay, so using for an example, I just watched The Crown season 4 recently.
Yeah.
And, for example, like Emma Corrin, who plays Diana.
Yeah.
And who plays Charles, cracking actor.
I can't think of his name.
Oh, my God. My wife knows him. Suddenly forgotten his name. Anyway, brilliant as well. They do great, I think. Like, they give you flavours of... I mean, my God, actually, in episode 1, Emma Corrin seems so like Diana, but they obviously give, like, a really good flavour and a sense and a feeling of Charles and Diana. But it's not like you're watching impersonations. And I just thought they were tremendous. And whereas, weirdly, in The Haunting of Bly House, you can get over bad accents, I think, strangely, even though it can be a bit jarring to your ear at first. You then just start to accept that that's the way they speak, and you get on with it.
To spread the blame and not feel as if we're piling on Bly Manor, I had that with The Boys.
Yeah.
The Boys...
Yes. I was going to say The Boys.
The Boys, initially, Urban's accent, it's like, that's such an almost comedy Cockney accent. But then I'm a huge fan of the comics, and the comics are written in kind of almost a comedy Cockney. It's like, it's clearly over the top in the writing. So... That was another one, though. As soon as I watched a couple of episodes, I was like, accent isn't great. I can now accept that and absolutely adore it as a show. It's one of my favourite shows. I think it's amazing. So, yeah.
Oh, I think it's absolutely brilliant. Funnily enough, I self-taped for that role of Billy Butcher, but obviously if they were getting...
So did I.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
And the French part as well.
I mean, I was looking now, like looking at these Zooms, we've both got quite slender faces, big beards. We're probably going to find that there's a lot of roles that we've both been up for or self-taped for.
Yeah. 100%. My wife, actually, who's a casting director, very nicely the other day, just told me, I mean, you look like a lot of people.
Yeah.
You're not very unique. I was like, thanks.
Yeah.
She's good for, like, really... bringing me down to earth.
Genuinely, only yesterday, my partner said about someone who's a friend of mine has just finished the script on their next series. And my partner said, oh, you should hit them up and see if there's anything that you would fit. And I said, no, look, they're closer friends with Brett. And again, he's another one that kind of looks like us. So I was like, if there's a role for me, Brett would be better suited to it, and they're good friends. So I'm just not gonna reach out. Like, he can cover that. It's gonna suit him more.
Yeah, I've been up for a few things that Brett's been up for as well. But yeah, I thought when I taped for that, I thought my Cockney was okay. But as you say, it was written quite cartoony.
Yeah.
So you think, well, I'll do it quite cartoony. But then when I saw the first episode, and I love the show, I did think, okay, well, actually, I probably would have been okay doing the accent after all. But weirdly, again, I don't think it detracts from it.
No.
His character does seem a little bit different from the rest of them, actually.
Yeah.
But it's a cracking show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of cracking shows, it's interesting to hear of your trailer-made talk show. Because you've kind of, it feels like that was obviously a good training ground for something that you've come out with in the pandemic or been involved with in the pandemic of Starfalls.
Yeah.
How's that been? Because the first episode had, or the lead in this Starfalls, which is, again, it's a Star Trek style show, but all shot from isolation on iPhones and then all pieced together. The lead is previous Distraction Pieces guest James McAvoy, but then as it's gone on, there's been Mick Foley, another previous guest in Florence Pugh, who I know was like just a big fan, and Kit Harington. You've had some. The cast is like any TV show would kill for this cast, and it's you guys. So how's that been?
Do you know, it's just been really funny and mad how it's kind of gained steam. So it's not like the guys that wrote it, Kevin Maynes and Brendan O'Rourke, they had done a couple at the start of lockdown, and they did this one called LA Noir, which was like a kind of spoof LA Confidential.
Yeah.
And they did it the same way. They filmed their scenes individually on their phones and they edited it together. That's quite hard to say.
Yeah.
Edited it together. and I saw LA Noir and I was like, that's fucking hilarious. If you do another one, can I please be in it? So they then did the next one called Robo Knight, which was like a fantasy spoof of RoboCop. And I played this like wise old, like wizardy guy who turned into a robot. And I did like a really, really, really bad, although this wasn't meant to be bad, but it was bad, like Werner Herzog impression.
Amazing.
And,
but again, Vern is another one who doesn't sound like anyone else. It feels like he's doing a cliche impression or a cliche voice.
Completely, completely. And I thought, you know, like, we're all just having fun. I filmed it here, like, literally where I'm sitting right now. I filmed it on my phone. And then I'm friends with James McAvoy, and I'd showed it to James and a couple of other people. And I had already said to Kevin and Brendan, I was like, if you do another one, I wonder if I should ask James, but I was like, I don't know if James does stuff like that. He's like, he's, you know, he's quite selective about what he does in general. And yeah. I don't know. And I showed it to him and he said, if you do another one, can I be in it? So I went back to Kevin and Brendan. I was like, listen, James McAvoy's actually asked to be in it. And so James is a massive Star Trek fan. I'm a massive Star Trek fan. And Kevin's quite a big Star Trek fan. So I was like, why don't we do a Star Trek spoof? So Kevin and Brendan went and wrote it, and the rest is history. And, you know, we did it in the same way. We all just filmed our own scenes on our phones in the house. I then asked Katrina Balfe to do it because I knew that Katrina's a really, really, really good laugh.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's like, you know, in films or TV or whatever, if you've got James McAvoy or someone like James in it, suddenly the whole project becomes attractive.
Of course it does. I'm doing this show filmed on iPhones. It's a bit silly. I'm doing this show with James McAvoy filmed on iPhones. It sounds completely different. It's two different propositions.
100%. And I knew that by asking James and by asking Katrina and by asking these other people, that my part and Kevin's part and Brendan's part and our parts were just going to be kind of diminished more and more, but it becomes more exciting and it gets people to watch it. And it was never a bit, it was always just about fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, and kind of staying, you know, doing something creative during lockdown. And then episode two, Sam did it from Outlander, Sam Hewen, and Teresa Palmer from A Discovery of Witches. But yeah, I have to say, out of Kit Harington and Florence, my crowning, my favourite piece of casting was Mick Foley, aka Mankind.
Just, I didn't see it coming at all. Didn't see it coming in the slightest. Because again, this industry is a weird one. So again, it's completely reasonable that you're mates with James McAvoy. It's completely reasonable that Florence Pugh will be like, oh, I've seen this. But Mick Foley is outside of that. It's always that excitement of, what? How did this happen?
It turns out, Sam Hewen had tweeted something because he'd been getting abuse or problems online from trolls on Twitter. And so he put out a statement basically saying that he was taking legal action. And Mick Foley quote tweeted this statement saying, hey, Sam, you're such a great guy. And basically he was supporting Sam. And amazing. I was like, Mick Foley, holy shit. Because I was a big, big, big WWF fan as it was back then in the 90s. And I'd read.
Same.
I had read his autobiography in the 90s.
It's Have a Nice Day, yeah.
Yeah. So I tweeted him and just said, wow, like you've got Mick Foley's support. I don't think it gets much better than that. And Mick Foley tweeted me back. And then I followed him and he followed me and I private messaged him and just said, listen, I have to say, I'm such a big fan of yours. I'm so excited. Turns out he's a huge, huge, huge Outlander fan.
Oh, wow.
And I said, look, we're doing this thing. We're doing this thing called Star Force. It's got, and this is the thing, I was like, it's got.
With James McAvoy.
Yeah, but he wasn't bothered about that. I was like, it's got James McAvoy. It's got Teresa Palmer. I was like, it's got Sam Hewen and Katrina Balfe from Outlander. And he was like, I'm doing it straight away.
Amazing.
And he did it, and he said that his mum, now, this is a guy who's had three books, I think, in the New York Times bestseller list and all the other achievements. And he said that his mum was more proud of him being in Star Force with some of the Outlander cast than anything else he's done.
Amazing.
Which is, you know. And can I actually also just say as well, he is the fucking nicest guy. He does this thing every Christmas where he dyes his massive beard white and he dresses up as Santa and he records, for some people, what he called Santa messages. Yeah. He recorded a Santa video message for my daughter last week.
Amazing.
And sent it. And I'm not, so my daughter's just about to turn 3, so she's really caught up in the magic and stuff. And she was watching this video and she was literally just like, wow, like transfixed.
Yeah.
So, and he just does it because he loves Christmas and he's just a good guy.
He's been doing it for years now, hasn't he? Like, as he was finishing up in wrestling, he kind of has continued it ever since. But, I mean, I think it's worth lingering on this just a brief bit longer, because it's so easy, as we did at the start of this, to get caught up in the negatives of social media and the negative impact it's had and things like that. But it's easy to ignore the beautiful moments it can bring like that. Like just the you and Mick Foley going back and forth and chatting. But then that going on to him doing a Santa video for your daughter and all this kind of thing. It's like all of that could never have happened pre-social media. You wouldn't have bumped into each other and he'd go, oh, I happen to be a big fan of Outlander. He would have lived his life as a big fan of Outlander. You would have lived your life as someone who was in Outlander. And the two would never have crossed paths. You wouldn't have known that those things existed. Like I had it really early on in my music career, and I've remained good friends with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, but that purely came about because they tweeted about one of our songs. And I was like, I've got a signed DVD from those guys. I've got everything they've ever done.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was that early exposure to the fact that, because again, I don't know about you, but I'm not the kind of guy that is ever going to be at celebrity parties or these kind of things where you're meant to meet these people and interact and go back and forth. But social media allows that a bit to go, hello, I like your stuff. And you go, oh shit, that's fucking awesome, man. I like your stuff too.
Oh, completely. And I think I've definitely had far, 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 far more positive experience on Twitter than negative. The only negative experiences I ever have on Twitter, and I don't actually even see them as negative, is sometimes if I've tweeted about Trump or something, I guess, because I've got quite a lot of American followers from Outlander, sometimes some of them will be Republican fans, and that will cause a bit of a, that's caused a bit of a stramash. But generally speaking, you know, like I think 99.9% of the people that follow me are Outlander fans, and the Outlander fan base is so enthusiastic. It's always very, very, it's normally always very positive. And as a result of that, like I've had strange interactions on Twitter with like Donny Osmond one time tweeted me back. I tweeted myself in my kitchen singing a song that he sings from Mulan. And he fucking like quote tweeted it back and commented on it. And then his sister, Marie Osmond, who weirdly, I support Kilmarnock Football Club in Scotland. She sang a song called Paper Roses in the 70s, which we've adopted as our anthem for some reason.
Yeah.
She then picked up in the tweet and she tweeted me back as well. And suddenly you're in a conversation with the Osmonds on Twitter. And it's just, I don't think I'll ever, I have to be careful sometimes, especially on jobs, you know, because when you're on jobs, I think you have to try and, I'll always have respect for people, but I have to try and also on set and on the job, just be like, right, well, we're all actors here and we're all doing the same job. But I don't think I'll ever quite stop being a fan as well.
Yeah.
You know, like I love meeting people or interacting with people that I admire or respect or, you know, look up to.
Yeah, completely. Oh, two things on fans then. And the first one, I'll be brief, but I think Scottish football fans adopt songs better than anyone else. The video, what club has Sunshine on Leaf?
Hibs.
The video of the Hibs fans singing Sunshine on Leaf is one of the, like, I'm a huge Proclaimers fan. I think they're one of the most underrated acts ever. They're seen as this, particularly in the UK, they're seen as this novelty band, but amazing songwriters. And that performance from the Hibs fans of Sunshine on Leaf is amazing. And similarly, there seems to be so many Scottish football teams or fans that adopt songs that aren't just a chant or have been written for their club and just do these beautiful performances, because where else would you get to hear a few thousand burly men harmonizing on a on a song? It's an emotional thing.
Well, that Hours is actually, I think, definitely up there with one of the strangest songs. And nobody ever really quite knows why we adopted Paper Roses by Marie Osmond. I think it was number one at some point during our history when we were doing okay. And the song, when she sings it, the funny, like, it, you know, it's quite a nice song. And it's like, what is it? It's like, she's like, I realize the way your eyes deceive me. Da, 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 da. And it's all quite melodic and nice. And then you hear us and it's just like, you know, a few thousand Kelly fans like, I realize the way your eyes, you know, and it just sounds absolutely horrendous. And it's not normally when you get like a few hundred or a few thousand people singing something together, it sounds a bit better.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's necessarily the case with Paper Roses.
I'd love to see a singer like Marie Osmond see what the difference is between singing with your hands at your waist and two hands overhead. See if that genuinely affects it in the way it does. But, I mean, speaking of enthusiastic fans, we need to talk about A Discovery of Witches, because you're new to the show, but
yeah,
the fans are so enthusiastic. Like, the Comic-Con panel was one of the biggest, most watched they've ever had. And it's often the way when things come over from a book that someone's connected to in their youth so deeply and so personally. I think there is a different connection with literature because it's all inside your own head. So you've completely created it. Rather than I'm watching a TV and it's on the other side of my eyes as such.
With a book,
it's on that side. So
yeah,
tell me about the show a bit and tell me about kind of joining a show like that. Because with Outlander, you know, you've been there a long time, but this is you kind of jumping in season two.
The premise of the show initially, it's, Teresa Palmer plays Diana Bishop.
Yeah.
And Matthew Good plays Matthew de Clermont, although he goes by several different surnames in it. She's a witch. He's a vampire. Witches and vampires are not meant to be together.
Yeah, we all know that. But it's like cats and dogs.
Yeah, we all know that. We all know that. There's huge. I mean, the story's actually really. It's. I think genre pieces sometimes get a little bit not necessarily the complete respect they deserve or the theme. Like, there's huge themes in Discovery of Witches, and it's really complex as well.
Or it's a mystery as well. It's kind of, I love that it's a mystery and a fantasy. It's not just here's this fantastical, here's our crazy, unusual characters. It's like, no, we're discovering stuff, and it's driven by mystery and intrigue rather than just the fantastical, I guess.
Yeah, and you have the congregation, and it, you know, you've got big kind of almost, I feel, mafia like family stories at stake as well. Lots of cracking, really interesting characters, and I think, you know, when I watched season one, I loved the books as well, but I thought season one was like so beautifully shot, and you know, it's got a fantastic cast as well. So when I got the part, or when I got the audition for season two, and then got offered the part, I was really excited about going into it, because unlike Outlander, when I got the part in Outlander, I knew nothing about it. I wasn't on social media. I didn't join social media for quite a while after. And then I kind of found out about the books, and it was a kind of different. I didn't feel any weight of expectation or anything like that. Whereas with Discovery of Witches, I think because I'd had that experience on Outlander, I was very aware that Galloglass, the part I play, is a big fan favourite from the books. And in Outlander, even though my character in Outlander is a bit of a fan favourite as well, there wasn't an expectation about who should play him.
Yeah.
Whereas like with this, because I Googled to find out more about Galloglass, and some of the names that the fans were coming up with for who to play him are quite fantastical in themselves.
Yeah.
But I was actually mostly just... I've never joined, don't know if you have, but I don't think I've ever joined a show after the first season.
Right.
And because I loved the first season so much, and it was also really successful, so it's nice joining a successful show with like a host of really cracking actors as well. I was a little bit nervous, definitely, but I was mostly just excited about going into that world. And I fucking love as well. I was a kid, you know. When I grew up, I read, you know, I loved all the Enid Blyton, Magic Wishing Chair, books. I loved The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, you know, The Hobbit, the Harry Potter books and stuff. I've always loved fantasy.
Yeah.
And I love the Twilight films and stuff as well. Like, for, you know, I love all that stuff for what it is. So it was cool getting to play a vampire.
There's something completely different, isn't there, about getting to lose yourself in a world like that. The UK is really good at gritty realism from your This Is England's to your Beats or Ned's or all sorts of other amazing stuff in Scotland, Ireland as well. So much good gritty realism. And I think at first that's often the kind of, right, that's what I want to be aiming towards. Or for me, at least, it was like, that's the kind of thing. I want to be an actor. I need to get these roles and do this. And then when you actually get to start playing stuff, you realise the absolute appeal of something that's completely outside of your realm, your knowledge and all that kind of thing, to go, wow, I get to play, as you say, a vampire. And again, a cool as fuck vampire. Like, not just kind of a cliche. It's like, I get to play one who's slick and kind of the guy kind of thing. So
yeah, he's like a total rock, you know. Obviously season two is in 1590, and even of that era, he's a bit kind of rock and roll compared to everyone else in it. And then, you know, season three, 400 years on, he's a biker. And the great thing about that as well, amazing. I think, I remember when I was self-taping for it, my wife is a casting director, and she's really good at telling me when I'm fucking shit. Not so good at telling me when I'm good, actually, but that's fine. It's good to know when you're shit. And I remember when I was self-taping for that, and I had a scene where I was talking about, you know, witches' hands and the brains of demons and da-da-da-da. And I did it a couple of times, and she was like, nah, I just don't believe you at all. And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, stop thinking about witches or demons or... This is real people. This is the world that you've got to add. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I thought I was, actually. But she was like, no, you're not. You know, you're not. You need to you need to buy into that stuff. You need to sell it. And you need to believe that that's a world that you're in.
Yeah, I love that. That's amazing advice. Because, again, I think it's so easy with anything that is genre to fall into these holes and or these clichés. I remember, like, one of the first things I got was a period piece, and I got told after the casting, the reason I got it was because it was being filmed in the UK. It was set in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So all the drama school kids were coming in and playing it like Shakespeare. And because I didn't go to any kind of drama school or anything, I went in and played it as me. I said their words and used their language, but just said it as me. And they were like, yeah, you've got it. That's that. Because, again, I think it is easy. And that makes perfect sense of, I'm sure I would do exactly the same. I would become a vampire and be a vampire. And it's like, what are you doing? That's not... You're meant to be a real vampire, not a vampire in a film.
It's very easy to... Yeah, you do kind of slide into, and I'm going to start speaking like this with my... You know, which I probably do speak a little bit like that sometimes in the show. But... it's very easy exactly to fall into those tropes. And I think I definitely did that when I came out at drama school. When I came out of drama school, I would go in thinking, oh, I need to act like I'm from 1900s.
Yeah.
Without realizing that they were just people in 1900s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they were still just human beings, but would adopt this slightly stiff manner of walking or talking or something. Hence why I probably didn't work much.
Yeah. A big thing for me is acknowledging that so much of the work is in the script.
Mm.
Again, I think actors want to believe that we are this magnetic force that is going to change everything. And with me here, it's all going to be different.
You
need to do your job. You need to bring what you bring. But the script is the key there. So it's that kind of, as you said, if the script is feeling authentically medieval or whatever else, then you need to just go and be a real person and let their words set the period rather than your actor voice. You know?
Totally. And, you know, particularly on something like A Discovery of Witches, and I think Al Pacino said something like this once as well, and Discovery of Witches, I really felt, you know, in season two, when I put on my costume, when I put on my wig, And when I got on to the, which I fucking loved, I've won a few wigs and shows and I've hated a few wigs and shows. This is the best wig I have ever had. People thought it was my real hair, even when they were really close up to me. It fitted my head so well. The costume was amazing as well.
I mean, I said the first season all looked stunning, and what I've watched of the second season, it's not slowing down there. It's exciting when when things look that beautiful.
It really is, and you're on set, and I feel like that's like 90% of my work is already done. And as long as I can hopefully say the lines in the correct order and bring something to it as well. But so much of the character, and that's why I think, well, I totally, totally agree with you. It's not like actors just walk on and, oh yeah, maybe there's a bit of magic or a bit of alchemy or something. We need a good script. You know, you need so many other elements for you to be good.
I was going to say, and it sounds like I'm now just trying to get work, but I think the casting directors are a big part of that alchemy. Because again, I think
totally.
It takes so much out of the work side of it if everyone is there together and it clicks and it works. And you, as much as you can see the character as soon as you put the wig on and everything, so can they. You know, as everyone comes together, it's like, right, this is us now. The main thing we need to do, as you say, is get the words in the right order. We've got the characters here. It's done it.
Totally.
It's done the job.
Like being married to a casting director and, I've really seen over the last few years, it's a job that I never used to fully understand. And I think a lot of actors, and certainly my early days as well, you have this almost feeling that casting directors are against you or something, this misguided thought that they're not for you.
Yeah.
And they just totally, they're for every single actor that comes into that room. They want them to be brilliant, and be the one that can get the job. And, that's what I think now anyway. And, you know, it's such a highly skilled job as well. They do so fucking hell. My wife works so hard and they're across so many aspects of the production. I'm glad that it's getting the recognition and it's getting some awards now as well, because I don't know if it's ever been recognised like that before. And because like you say, if the casting's right, then you rock up and it's like...
And again, I think you're right. I think Brett, again... Our friend Brett Goldstein has always laughed at me a bit because I'm always just, I'll come out of things and go, I love that. Like, I'm really into castings and casting directors. I thoroughly enjoy them. I think they're amazing. I've only had like one maybe that I thought was a bit of a dick. But I think part of that as well is because I didn't come through drama school. And again, to be clear, if it sounds as if I'm saying everything's good because I didn't go, there's so much I wish I'd gone to drama school for. Every time I'm on set, I'm like, man, I wish I'd had more prep for this. But I think because you're in drama school, you're around your peers all the time. And I think that might subconsciously bring in a competition of the casting director is this thing that we have to overcome. Do you know what I mean? That, as you say, that they are the enemy in some way. But the first gig I ever did, Neil Maskell gave me a copy of Andy Nyman's Golden Rules of Acting.
Oh, I love Andy.
Which is absolutely amazing. And in that, one of the first things he says is, the casting director wants you to get the job because, as you say, they've got you in because they want you to get the job. And even on a more simple point of view, if you get it, then they can move on to the next character or role or whatever else they have to do. So they're on your side. They want you to do good. And that, I think that set me up really well early on, that I'm going in each time thinking, we can do this. I'll do my best and you do your best and we'll get the role and we can move on kind of thing.
Totally. And also another thing as well, and that I really learned from Callie too. Like, I've done a lot of, not so much the last few years, but certainly, a few years ago, I've done a lot of small parts in big films or parts with like three or four lines or whatever. And, sometimes I would get a little bit, my ego would be a bit offended when I was asked to come in and audition for this stuff. And Callum was like, they're not asking you to come in because they think you're shit. They're asking you to come in because they think you're good. And they want every single part in this film to be good, because we are not thinking, oh, it's all right, we'll get Stephen in, he's a bit shit, and that part of the film might not be so good, but that's all he's good for, so it's fine. It's like, we want, because it's like, they talk about keeping the ball bouncing. They talk about that in theatre sometimes.
Right.
And if the ball gets dropped, you notice it. So it's like, it doesn't matter if it's one line, if it's one word, if it's a look.
Yeah.
If it's a bit shit or something, you notice it. I was like, all right, okay, yeah, well, that makes sense. And because we've got, you know, I'm much thicker skin now than I used to be, but I've definitely been a fragile, sensitive sort over the years, you know. Yeah. I still am, but not as much.
I think I'm the same. I like to think I'm very thick-skinned and all that, but I recently, in this period of lockdown or whatever, I went back and just thought I'd have a look at an update on a role I went that I was up for and didn't get. It was one of them that, in general, yeah. I'm really good at doing them and forgetting and moving on. And this one, I was like, I really wanted that, but I got amazing feedback, and they decided to go from a particular region rather than casting.
Yeah.
Broader, and I know that they wanted me and all this kind of thing. So they'd said all the nice things to make my ego feel okay without getting the role. So I just went in out of a pure fan of the director to say, oh, I wonder how that's going. I'll go on IMDb. And Bjork had been added to the cast, and it just killed me because I'm a huge Bjork fan. So not only had I not got this role that was a dream director, a dream role, a dream project, I was like, I would have also been working with Bjork in her second, like her only role since Dancer in the Dark, which was just mind-blowing. And I had a couple of sleepless nights on that, just laying again.
Yeah.
Fuck's sake. What? This is so annoying.
I've definitely done that. I mean, I had to go through, it was a long spell where I was like, I need to eject IMDb off my phone and my computer.
Yeah.
It's like, it used to be like self-harm.
Yeah.
In a way. Yeah. But I'll just go and check. I'm just interested. Just want to see what it is. He's got it.
Yeah.
Fuck.
I had a period where three different things in a row went to Carl Urban. Which it turns out, I was like, what's going on? Why am I up for them? Carl Urban's amazing. Clearly you're going to go with Carl. If there's a choice of me or Carl Urban, pick Carl Urban, obviously. Yeah. But stop teasing me. Hey,
I've had the worst of worst. I've been up for a job before and Brett Goldstein got it.
I'm genuinely, me and Brett cracked up because I had a casting once and I went in. And it was one of the first things I'd gone for, like, which was comedy. And it went well. And again, I get on with casting directors. So we were chatting afterwards. And I said, you know, I'd be good for this role. Have you seen Brett Goldstein? And I came out and I mentioned it to Brett. He's like, why are you recommending other people in your own castings? This is you're the worst actor ever. I'm like, this is bad. But I'll wrap things up now. We've not touched upon Outlander, which we've not got time to. But, you know, your fans will be furious that we've not touched upon it, but you've talked about it a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so that. Listen, I've mentioned Sam Hughes and I've mentioned Hugh and Tox.
Yeah.
It's an offshoot of Outlander. It's like, covered. You know, I think that's, that's good. They enjoy Hugh and Tox as much as Outlander now, I think, to be honest.
Well, there's two things I want to end on. Number one, how is it having a character in a role that you kind of know the path of? Because that's kind of a rare thing in TV, like that, you know, in the next series, it's 400 years on and you've got this cool biker character.
Yeah.
That must be great, right? Because in general, particularly in TV, you're going a series at a time, more often an episode at a time, not really sure what is around the corner and what is going to happen.
Do you know what? I think it's both a mostly a blessing, but maybe a little bit of a curse in the sense that, yes, you get, you know, because I love the books and I think, you know, fans will get disappointed sometimes when certain things are left out of the TV or film adaptation. But of course, you cannot get everything in it. What's that expression? You have to writers? They have to
kill your darlings.
Kill your darlings. You know, so, but there were certain parts and there's a journey that it goes on in book three that when I read the synopsis and when I got the part, I thought, right, even last year, I thought I'm really looking forward to get into play, because that's a part that by that point I've been alive for about 800 years, and there's a storyline that happens that can only happen when you've been alive for 800 years.
Amazing.
So I was very excited about the prospect of playing that. I was a little bit like, his physicality is described a lot. I'm a bit like, in the books he's kind of described as towering over everyone a lot. I'm 5'10", 5'11", 5'11" with heels. So I don't exactly, I don't tower over everyone, but I made a real commitment to being in the gym all the fucking time. And I got physically in the best shape I've ever been in.
Fantastic.
I was a little bit, which has been great, but also because it's a TV series, there was a bit of me that was like, fuck, I'm going to have to do that for a while. That's not just for like a few months for a film. I'm going to have to do that for at least 18 months. Yeah. And that's been, my body has been getting a little bit sore.
Exhausted.
Recently. So I'm almost, But mostly, do you know what? Mostly it's just really, really exciting, like you say.
I love it. Well, to wrap things up, another thing I enjoyed at the start of this year was Cobra. I thought it's fantastic. Do you think our government wish they were more like Cobra than the thick of it? Because they're clearly the thick of it. But I think you watch Cobra and it was all so slick and so well thought out.
Yeah.
And then you turn on the TV and see the actual government and go, can't we have the Cobra guys doing this?
I know. Listen, I think like, but I became really good friends with Robert or Bobby Carlyle doing that. And he what like, you know, when we were doing it, he was a bit like, I have to say, Stevie, as a Tory Prime Minister, I kind of wondered myself. But you know, I think he does a cracking job in it, and it was so weird, you know, we were filming that and I remember when it came out. Now I think it did do pretty well anyway. I thought that was going to, and I think a lot of people involved in that thought it was going to do like incredibly well, and I don't know how you measure those things.
It was fantastic.
But
it was so everything was so polished and nicely, it all worked so well together.
Well, they're doing a season two of it, so it must have done pretty well. Yeah, I remember a couple of the reviews when it first came out kind of suggested it was a little bit far-fetched or stretching the realms of believability. And then like a month after it came out, we've got a fucking worldwide pandemic. And you're like, oh, hold on a minute. Like, it almost didn't go far enough. So much of what Ben Richards, the writer, creator of that, is amazing, I think. I mean, I loved, he also included, especially for me, which I was very proud of, I won't say it, but the C words.
Right,
which you do not hear much.
Not on TV.
TV.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think Sky, actually, I think it got edited out at one point, but then they put it back in, because it's so much part of the story. And Ben wrote that in, especially for me, which I'm strangely quite proud of, actually.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I mean, to wrap things up, and this is just on a personal, I need to share with you that a mate of mine has got a song out at the moment that's currently around number two in the charts for Christmas number one, called Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt. So again, it's it's even rarer that you get the C words in the charts. So it's an exciting time. That I mean, this will come out way after that, but it's exciting that we've got the potential of a Christmas number one that has that wonderful terminology in
such a
Well, thank you very much, man. It's been a pleasure. I don't think we've done help to the kind of, you know how Americans always think all British people know each other or all Scottish people know each other. You've mentioned being mates with James McAvoy and Robert Carlyle, so now they are just going to assume that is the case. They're all pals. But it's been a pleasure, man. I'm glad we've finally got to have a chat and a catch up on it all. I look forward to all that's ahead.
No, cheers, mate. Thank you. Take it easy. Take care.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 364 with Stephen Cree. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I loved having that conversation. We got to have a little bit of a chat afterwards as well. That was an absolute joy. Speaking of which, actually, next week's guest, it's a 90-minute conversation, and it's one of the best 90-minute conversations I've had. And then we chatted for a further half an hour after we stopped recording. So that tells you how good next week's podcast is. Yeah. Am I going to tell you who it is? No, I think I'll hold off. It's someone who's been talked about on the podcast a lot and has been requested for a long time. So yeah, you're going to love that one. Other than that, still as this strange era in 2020, we could keep saying what a weird year. In 2021, we've got to kind of refer to it as an era now. Because it's still going, man. But stay safe, stay sane, and if you can, Stay sexy. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.